doing work to serve your country, under strict supervision, of course.
I'd rather lobotomize myself with a spoon, Cade thought.
I understand this is a hard pill to swallow, Becker said, but it's a lot better than life in prison.
Is it? The world was spinning around him. He couldn't see straight. This was a nightmare.
There's one more condition, Becker was saying. You hand over all the work you've done on Nexus to us, and you walk our research team through what you've built and how.
Cade started. I just need some time to think about this.
Becker nodded again. Fine. Think about it. But don't think too long. We can hide that you're in our custody for a few more hours. After that, it'll be difficult. And if it's known that we had you, you'll be of no use to us. You'll get the book thrown at you.
The guards took him back to his cell. Cade lay on the cot and closed his eyes. Faces swam through his vision again. All the people who would be fucked if he didn't agree to this. And if he did agree to spy for them? If he did, then he might be helping the ERD screw over some scientist who is guilty of nothing. He'd be signing on to an organization that was almost his complete opposite in ideology. But I'd have options, he thought to himself. I wouldn't be in jail. I'd be working for them overseas. I could find a way out. I'd be part of a system I hate.
He wished his parents were alive. Dennis and Cheryl Lane had been scientists, a high-energy physicist and a research biologist, until a highway crash had taken both their lives late last year. He could use their counsel now. What would they say if they were here? A scientist is responsible for the consequences of his or her work. His dad had drilled that into his head again and again. The consequences of my work are jail for dozens of my friends, unless I do what the ERD wants. His thoughts chased their own tails for an hour. No matter how he looked at it, staying out of jail, keeping his friends out of jail, was better than having them all locked away. He couldn't have that many destroyed lives on his conscience. He had to make amends for leading so many people into trouble. His decision was clear. It left a vile taste in his mouth. So be it.
Briefing. Aryan Rising, a.k.a. Red Thursday. Event. Organization. Year? 2030. The Aryan Rising incident, 2030, was an attempt to wipe out the bulk of humanity, paving the way for the repopulation of the world by a race of genetically engineered neo-Nazi transhumans. On May 16, 2030, the U.S. public awoke to news of mass deaths in Laramie, Wyoming. See Red Thursday. American News Network and other news sources broadcast gruesome images of citizens of Laramie vomiting blood and collapsing in the street. National Guard and FBI bioterror quickly established a cordon around the town, which they maintained throughout the incident. Rapid sequencing established that the deaths were due to a heavily modified airborne variant of the Marburg virus, dubbed Marburg Red. Within 4 days, 90% of the residents of Laramie were dead, with a total death toll over 31,000. Heroic measures and the extremely short incubation time of the viral variant prevented the spread of Marburg Red beyond Laramie. In the aftermath of the attack, investigators discovered a compound to the west of Laramie containing 128 cloned children in 8 batches of 16, ranging in age from 3 to 15, and dozens of bodies of deceased adults. Subsequent investigation revealed that the cloned children had been created by a group referring to themselves as the Aryan Rising, and specifically engineered for immunity to Marburg Red, as part of an ideologically driven plot to wipe out inferior races and replace them with ethnically pure Übermenschen. Recordings from within the compound showed a group of the children deliberately releasing an early variant of Marburg Red months ahead of schedule, thus killing their creators and wiping out the nearby town. Had Marburg Red's creators been able to finish their design work and induce a longer incubation time, the death toll would have been far higher. Public reaction was at first horrified,
and subsequently extremely critical of FBI and DHS for their failure to prevent the attack. The event occurred near the peak of Dwitty abduction and mind control incidents, and on the heels of the Yucca Grove outbreak of Communion virus in 2028, and the deadly Eskaton computer attack of 2029. The combined public outrage from these events led to a steep drop in popularity of President Owen Asher and a marked increase in public support for laws restricting research into genetics, cloning, nanotechnology, artificial intelligence, and any approach to creating superhuman beings. Public response led to the Chandler Committee hearings of 2030 through 2031, the passage of the Chandler Act, and the creation of the ERD. These events also played a role in the presidential campaign of 2032, contributing to the election of Governor Miles Jamison as president and Senator, now President, John Stockton as vice president, and in the 2035 drafting of the Copenhagen Accords on Global Technological Threats. History of Advanced Technological Threats, ERD Library Series, 2039, Unclassified. 6. External Conditions.
"I'll do it," Cade told them.
"Good," Becker nodded. "You're making the right choice."
"So who am I spying on?" Becker tapped his slate and the wall screen came to life.
"Warning, the following material is classified. Top Secret Citadel 4. Disclosure of this material to uncleared individuals is a federal offense punishable by up to 30 years in prison." The twin logos of the Department of Homeland Security and the Emerging Risks Directorate within it bracketed the security clearance warning.
"You're about to receive top-secret information. Do you understand that disclosure of this information to anyone is a felony with severe penalties?"
Cade swallowed.
"Yes."
"Good,"
Becker said. He tapped his slate with a finger. The wall screen advanced to the next slide. On it was a picture of a tall, elegant Asian woman in her early 40s, caught looking to one side and smiling warmly at someone outside the image. Cade had seen her face before.
"Her name is Su-Yong Shu," Becker said. "You probably heard of her."
Cade was momentarily speechless.
"Su-Yong Shu? A murderer?"
Su-Yong Shu was perhaps the most impressive neuroscientist in the field. Asked to pick a working scientist who would one day win the Nobel Prize, Cade would have named her. She had done more to unlock the neural encoding of abstract reasoning, beliefs, motivations, and knowledge than anyone alive. Cade's work used statistical methods layered on top of models built in Su-Yong Shu's lab. She and her students put out a fire hose of top-notch papers. She was one of the most respected neuroscientists alive.
"You're calling Su-Yong Shu a murderer?" Cade asked. "Do you have any idea what you're talking about? Do you have any evidence to back that up?"
Becker tapped his slate. The screen changed again. Now it showed a picture of a man in the orange robes of a Buddhist monk, his shaven head bowed forward, kneeling in what looked to be a stone courtyard.
"This is a file photo of Lobsang Tulku, the Buddhist monk who shot and killed the Dalai Lama and two of his bodyguards in Dharamsala in 2037, and then took his own life."
Cade nodded. "I remember. He just snapped one day, right?"
"That's the story," Becker said. "We have reason to believe that's not what actually occurred. Instead, we believe that someone turned this man into a kind of puppet and used him to commit a political assassination."
Becker advanced the presentation again. The wall screen now showed a gruesome image of a 20-something Asian man in monk's robes in a pool of blood, two bullet wounds in his head. The Dalai Lama. Cade felt his stomach churn.
"Lobsang had no history of owning or using firearms," Becker said. "So far as we know, he'd never even touched a gun until a week before this event. Yet his marksmanship was impeccable. He fired 6 times, twice for each of the 2 bodyguards and twice for the Dalai Lama. Everyone was a headshot. He didn't miss with a single bullet."
Holtzman looked at Cade thoughtfully.
"You could do something like this, couldn't you? Make a person into a robot?"
Cade stared at the photo, In theory, with enough time...
He said nothing. Holtzman watched him for a moment, then nodded. Cade cleared his throat, trying to hold on to his skepticism.
Maybe there were things you didn't know about him. Maybe someone was training him all along, or planted him.
Becker cocked his head to one side.
Lobsang was a close associate of the Dalai Lama. They grew up together. He was an apparently devoted follower and friend of the Dalai Lama, an activist for Tibetan freedom. Until one day he decided to kill his lifelong friend, and did so with the skills of a professional assassin.
Becker continued.
We know that Lobsang was detained in Tibet by the Chinese a few months earlier. He was in custody for 48 hours and was then expelled from the country. Lobsang claimed that he spent most of that time in silent meditation in his cell. But if someone used a neurotechnology to alter his memories...
It's possible, Cade thought. Nexus would make a great assassination tool.
He shook his head again.
Propaganda is the first tool of government,
Watts had said. Skepticism. He would hold on to it.
What does this have to do with Su Yong Shu?
We'll get to that in a moment, Becker said.
He advanced the slide again. A ruined building appeared, obviously the site of an explosion. Bodies and wounded were strewn about, some of them in military uniform.
Grozny Chechnya, 2038. After nearly 5 years of peace, a young woman named Zamira Zakayev, a woman associated with a disarmed and peace accord-abiding Chechen independence group, blows up a nightclub popular with the Russian army. The event, which killed 74 civilians and 30 Russian soldiers, set off a wave of reprisals, which in turn set off more bombings. Russia moved 3 divisions of the Russian army back into the North Caucasus. The situation remains inflamed today.
I don't see the connection, said Cade.
Zamira Zakayev had traveled to China earlier in the year and had also been held for 2 days by the Chinese authorities for no obvious reason.
Why would China want to bomb a club in Chechnya?
It distracts the Russians, forces them to move their attention and their forces away from China.
Cade tried to absorb this. What did it have to do with Shu?
One more, Becker said. And then we'll get to why we think Su Yong Shu is involved.
Becker tapped his slate again. The screen now showed an Asian man in a suit, fist raised in triumph or defiance above him, standing at a podium surrounded by a throng of people, some waving banners.
This is Xian Liu, now president of Taiwan. This picture was taken on the eve of his election victory last year in 2039. President Liu was the head of the DPP, the primary opposition party in Taiwan, and ran his campaign on an anti-Beijing platform. He pledged to roll back major pieces of integration. On the campaign trail, he leveled sharp criticism at China on human rights, foreign policy, and its lack of internal reforms. In January of this year, President Liu went to Beijing for his first meeting with the recently installed Chinese premier.
Becker tapped, and the screen now showed Liu and an older Asian man, whom Cade recognized vaguely from the news, sitting side by side in ornate red and gold chairs. The men were smiling faintly, if at all. Becker continued.
During the visit, President Liu became suddenly ill. Apparently a case of the flu. He was admitted overnight to Beijing's Jade Palace Hospital, the best hospital in the country. He was discharged early the next morning, smiling and waving at reporters. Everything apparently all right. Aside from that, the trip was a major success, at least for China. Liu returned from Beijing singing a new tune. He flipped on nearly every topic of Taiwan-China relations, supporting deeper and faster integration and dropping all human rights and corruption objections. We believe Beijing turned him during that visit, though in a more subtle way than the previous 2 cases.
He's a politician, Cade said. Maybe he just changed his mind.
Becker smiled faintly.
That's a very reasonable suggestion. We wondered the same, and of course we wanted to be sure. Fortunately, during his trip to the U.S. last month, President Liu also became ill.
Becker smiled faintly again.
CIA took that as an opportunity to run a few tests on President Liu's blood and cerebrospinal fluid. His blood was clean, but in his cerebrospinal fluid they found signs of something that looks suspiciously like Nexus. That there are no signs of it in the bloodstream suggests to us that the Nexus-like substance isn't deteriorating and being flushed out of his brain as normal. The technology has been permanently integrated, something that you seem to have achieved as well.
Holtzman spoke again.
We look forward to hearing the details of just how you've achieved this.
Cade felt ill. Becker went on.
We have another 24 events we think are cases of Chinese compulsion technology at work. Do you see why we're concerned?
Yes, Cade said, and he did. They'd built Nexus OS to give people new freedoms, new ways to connect, new ways to learn, not to use it as a tool for control or assassination.
You asked about the involvement of Dr. Xu. We're now getting to that. First, we have human intelligence indicating that for the past several years she's been working with the Chinese military on coercion technologies of some sort. Second, we have direct evidence linking her to part of the Chinese super soldier program.
Becker tapped again, and the picture changed to a group of Asian soldiers in a parade. Something about the grain and focus suggested to Cade that the photo had been taken from very far away with a very long zoom lens.
Do you notice anything interesting about this photo?
Becker asked. Cade studied it, not sure what he was looking for. The soldiers were in their 20s, muscular and fit, with identical crew cuts, dress uniforms, and sophisticated rifles of some kind against their right shoulders. They were all poised in mid-step, postures erect and in complete synchrony, faces cold and blank. He wondered if he was supposed to recognize one of them. Asian faces all looked a bit alike to him, though these faces looked extremely alike. A trick of the haircuts? Or... They're identical, he said. Becker nodded.
This is a detachment of the Confucian Fist Special Forces Battalion. They're clones, which is itself a violation of Copenhagen. We also have reports that this battalion, the most elite in China's armed forces, has been engineered for unshakable loyalty.
Cade shuddered. He had a flash of memories of newscasts from his teens, the Nazi clone kids, the ones who'd tried to wipe out all of humanity, rows of them filing out from the compound, eyes totally cold, killers at age 10. He tried to suppress it. Becker saw the reaction.
You're thinking of the Aryan Rising case. We haven't seen any major cloning projects since then. Nothing at this level. Not until now.
Cade shook his head, forced himself to think like a scientist.
They're just twins, he said. That's all cloning is. The Nazi kids, they had programming beyond that. Just because someone's a clone doesn't make them evil, any more than any twin is.
Becker nodded thoughtfully.
Sure, you're right, just twins. But you have to ask yourself, why would someone create a couple hundred copies of the same twin?
Cade shrugged.
I don't know. Maybe they want blood transfusions to be easier, or organ transplants.
Becker nodded again, seeming to consider this.
Or maybe they want conformity, control. Maybe they want predictability. Maybe they want to do really invasive neurocoercion, and making the brain structure as similar as possible makes that easier, eh?
Becker raised an eyebrow at him. Cade looked at the cold, hard, identical faces of the clone soldiers again. Becker's answer was all too plausible.
And indeed, Becker went on. You can see them deployed in a number of the situations where absolute, unquestioning loyalty would be most demanded. You can see two of them here.
The wall flipped to an image of the Chinese premier with two bodyguards in view. They had the same face as the soldiers he'd just seen.
Another one here with Dr. Xu.
The screen showed a picture of Su Yong Xu entering her car. The driver holding open the door was one of the clones.
"And another one here with Su Yongshu's husband, Chen Pang, head of the artificial intelligence program at Jiaotong University."
A shot of a no-nonsense-looking Chinese man in a suit crossing a plaza, caught in the middle of a purposeful stride, a dark-suited bodyguard at his side, again with the same face.
"That Dr. Xu and her husband have Confucian fist bodyguards isn't damning in and of itself. But take a look at this."
The screen showed four rows of Confucian fist soldiers, arms clasped behind their backs in parade rest. In front of them, facing the camera, was a smiling Su Yongshu, her arms spread as if to point out the young men behind her. Unlike the other photos, the soldiers were smiling in this one.
"This was a graduation ceremony for a class, or batch, of Confucian fist. Why is Dr. Xu there if she wasn't involved in the program? And given that she's a neuroscientist who's been fingered for working on coercion technologies, and that these soldiers are reputed to be engineered for unshakable loyalty, well, it doesn't take much to connect the dots."
Cade opened his mouth to interject, but Becker kept talking.
"One more piece of evidence."
The screen changed again. Now it showed a market somewhere in the tropics, perhaps Southeast Asia. Su Yongshu was in the middle of the photo, delightedly holding an exotic fruit of some sort to her nose. Next to her was a lean, tall Asian man wearing dark sunglasses.
"This photo was taken in Chiang Mai, Thailand, 2 years ago. The man next to Dr. Xu is Tanum Ted Pratnung. Ted Pratnung is an American-educated Thai synthetic chemist and nano-engineer, 42 years old, PhD from Stanford in 2024, where he focused on self-assembling nanostructures. Postdoc at Jiaotong University in Shanghai from 2024 through 2026, where it's possible he met Su Yongshu. His whereabouts between 2026 and 2034 are unknown. After 2034, he re-emerges as a major source of Nexus 3. We believe he synthesizes it in a facility, or set of facilities, in the eastern provinces of Thailand, close to the border with Cambodia. He's someone we'd very much like to get our hands on, but the Thai government has not been cooperative. Pratnung and Xu's research interests essentially do not overlap at all. Seeing them together is provocative, to say the least. To summarize, we believe that Su Yongshu is one of, if not the primary, scientists behind China's neurotech program focused on coercion, and that in this work she somehow adapted Nexus 3. We're concerned both about what China could do with this technology, and perhaps even more so, what knowledge Su Yongshu might pass back into the black market via her connection with someone like Ted Pratnung.
Cade took a deep breath. "Don't buy into what they're selling," he told himself. "These people lie or distort the truth to convince me. Stay skeptical. Learn for yourself."
"So why me?"
he asked. Becker answered.
"You're about to get an invite to a special workshop on decoding higher brain functions, to be held immediately after the upcoming International Society for Neuroscience conference in Bangkok. Su Yongshu arranged the invitation. You'll be the only grad student at the invite-only workshop. Everyone else is a tenured professor. That indicates some degree of exceptional interest in you. We know Xu has open postdoctoral positions in her lab, and you're going to get your PhD in the next year. Your work already builds on some of hers. It seems like a good fit."
Now, Cade was nervous.
"So you're asking me to spy on someone who could conceivably have me killed, or something, if she finds out?"
Becker smiled slightly.
"Rest assured, we'd pull you out immediately if we perceived you as being in any danger. And you'll have support with you at the conference. If something long-term emerges in Shanghai, you'd have support there as well."
"I don't have much choice, do I?" he thought.
Maybe Ilya was right. We could have gone to the press, to the public. No, it wouldn't have worked. How many stories like that had Cade heard about in the past? Had he done anything? He'd signed some online petitions. Had he rushed to people's defenses? Had scientists around the country risen up in protest? Fat chance. Everyone just kept their head down, massaged their research proposals, tried to skirt as close to the edge of what was allowed as they could without endangering their federal grant dollars. He felt sick, ashamed of himself, ashamed of his profession. Becker closed the cover of his slate and looked at Cade.
For the last topic, and for the technology briefing we'd like you to do for us, I turn to Dr. Holtzman. And now I must attend to other matters. Dr. Holtzman will see to your transport back to San Francisco. We'll send someone with you to confiscate any Nexus materials you have there. Aside from that, we'll be in touch shortly. We have 2 months until the ISFN meeting, and we'll be asking a fair bit of preparation from you, most of it to ensure your safety.
With that, Becker got up, took his slate, and exited the room, closing the door behind him. Cade's head was spinning. Technology briefing. Confiscate Nexus materials. He was having trouble breathing again. He could feel his heart beating in his chest. They were taking Nexus away from him. They were taking it for themselves. He was handing them this power and giving up on it himself. He had to find a way to limit the damage they could do. But how could he?
He was dimly aware of Holtzman saying something to him. He missed it for a moment. The idea came to him whole. Was it possible? Yes.
Was there time?
He had no idea.
Holtzman said something again. Cade snapped back to the room.
Sorry, I missed that.
I asked if you're well, the elder scientist replied.
No, I'm not well, but I'm not going to roll over either, he thought.
Sorry. It's just a lot to take in.
Holtzman nodded.
Do you need a break?
Cade blinked. What was done. He could only move forward.
No, I'm fine now. Let's go on.
Holtzman nodded again, opened his own slate, tapped on it for a moment, and the wall screen transitioned to a new slide, showing a single graph labeled Su-Yong Shu, Impact Factor of New Publications. Holtzman spoke.
We have one last piece of background on your mission for today. It concerns Su-Yong Shu. She's an exceptional scientist. From the very beginning of her career, that has been apparent. A number of years ago, however, something changed.
Cade absorbed the graph as Holtzman spoke. Shu's impact factor rose rapidly, solidly through her early career. Then there was a break, 3 years gone from science, while she took time off to raise her daughter. When the line reappeared, it was markedly higher than it had been when it dropped off. And it had a new, steeper slope, rising faster and faster every year.
As you can see, Cade, the career trajectories before 2029 and after 2032 appear quite different. Those 3 years represent a discontinuity. The early Su-Yong Shu showed every sign of a successful career. The Su-Yong Shu of 2032 and later goes beyond that. She shows signs of almost superhuman brilliance.
Cade considered for a moment.
Maybe she did a lot of thinking while she was at home. Came up with new ideas.
Holtzman nodded.
That would produce a temporary boost upon her return. Instead, what we see is a long-term acceleration. Every year after 2032, she diverges further and further from her pre-2032 trajectory. This sort of change is unprecedented.
Cade tilted his head.
You think something changed about her? That she got smarter? Augmented?
We have no proof, Holtzman said slowly. But this is very suggestive.
Cade nodded. Her work was indeed very, very good. Awe-inspiring even.
The kind of augmentation you're talking about, that's not just a little memory boost or concentration aid. It's better pattern recognition.
Better creativity. You're talking about enhancements beyond anything known about in the field today.
Holtzman nodded.
Yes, she shows signs of being augmented in ways that surpass anything that we know of. That is something which concerns us.
He paused, then continued.
And it's interesting that the first report of Nexus One came in 2033, just 7 years ago, and 1 year after Dr. Shu's return to science.
Holtzman let that hang in the air. Cade frowned.
You're saying Su Yong Shu may have created Nexus? She's not a nano-engineer.
Do you know any nano-engineer who could have designed Nexus?
No, not even close, he thought.
A team of engineers, Cade suggested. We've had teams of nano-engineers look at Nexus, try to reverse-engineer it, Holtzman said. The Japanese, Germans, Brits, and Indians all have as well. No one has more than scratched the surface.
So what are you saying? Cade asked.
I'm saying that Nexus may defy human understanding because it is not the product of normal human thought, Holtzman said. It is the product of post-human thought.
And you're sending me to spy on her? Cade thought.
Holtzman tapped his slate. The wall screen went dark and the room lights rose.
Now it is time for you to brief us on your Nexus 5 work, and transfer to us all materials you have on it. All design notes, experimental results, all of it.
Cade swallowed.
The materials are in SF.
Holtzman raised one white bushy eyebrow.
It's a precaution we took, Cade said. The master code is on a system that's kept offline.
Very well. We will do the first stage of the technology briefing now, and we'll send an officer with you back to your lab to retrieve this data. You'll hand all data and physical materials over to our officer, and he'll return them to us.
Cade bowed his head in assent.
Here we go.
Warren Becker opened the door into the room where Sam stood, silently observing the briefing Cade was receiving through a viewscreen. Becker walked up to her, placed his hand on her shoulder.
Sam, how's that injury?
Sam nodded, put a hand on her side.
Healing, sir. The growth factors are doing their work. I should be fully fit for service in a week.
Good, Becker said. What did you think of the briefing?
Sam shook her head.
There's a lot there. I wish I'd known the whole picture before the mission last night.
Some of it was need to know, Sam. We didn't expect things to go the way they did last night.
Sam nodded.
Yes, sir. I understand.
She paused for a moment, then continued.
Sir, I'm not sure that I'm the right person for the next phase of this mission.
Becker snorted.
Sam, you're the perfect person for this mission. You have more experience with Nexus than any field agent, and you have a great alias that fits the mission needs.
I know, it's just...
Becker waited a moment, and then prompted,
The failure of your memory implants was a valuable lesson, Sam. We'll improve the implantation process from that. You'll be better prepared for a Nexus 5 connection than any agent who hasn't experienced it.
That's not it, sir. I enjoyed it, sir. I question my objectivity.
Becker chuckled.
If drugs weren't enjoyable, people wouldn't abuse them. There's nothing new there.
Sam looked down at her hands.
How to get through to him? Sir, when I was being held captive, and no longer part of the Nexus connection that they'd established, I missed it. I wanted to be back in that loop. I wanted... something that goes against everything I stand for.
Sam was faltering now.
Agent Kataranis!
Becker said it in a tone of command. Sam snapped her eyes to him.
Samantha, I know how you were raised. I know what happened to you and your family at Yucca Grove. I know about communion virus and the things you were exposed to. It's exactly because of those experiences that I have complete faith in you. You, among all people, understand the dangers of this tech. I know you won't falter in your duty. You're going on this mission because you're the available field agent with the best relevant experience and positioning. You're going because I have 100% confidence in you. And you're going because it's an order. Is that understood?
Sam let go of the breath she was holding.
Yes, sir. Understood.
Becker smiled fractionally.
Good. Now, we have an additional briefing for you. Tell me what I haven't told Caden Lane.
Sam turned her eyes back to the briefing room, where Cade and Holtzman were finishing up.
At a guess, this mission isn't just to learn what we can from having someone close to Su Yongshu. If possible, you want more. You want her to try to turn Cade with whatever techniques she's been using, so we can study them in depth.
Sam paused for a moment, then finished her thought.
Which means that Cade isn't just a spy, she said. He's bait.
7. Explanations. Transcript. Rangan Shankari, Tech. Briefing, Nexus 5. Sunday, February 19th, 2040. 0951 hours. Note. Subject should be considered hostile. Interviewer.
Okay, let's start again. Tell us about Nexus 5.
Shankari, inaudible, likely profanity.
Fine. Nexus 5 is Nexus, but with software layered on top.
What does that mean?
We found a way to program it. We found a way to get data in and out, to get instructions in and out.
What kind of data?
Neural data at first. We were using it as a way to measure neural firing in the motor cortex. Individual neurons, but millions of them at a time.
This was for your research?
Yeah. The goal was to get the data from the brain, decode it, and use it to control a robot arm.
Systems like that already exist. Why the research?
Existing systems get implanted surgically. That limits them. The procedures are long. You can get infections. And you can only tap into tens of thousands of neurons. The motor cortex is maybe 10 billion neurons. With Nexus, we could tap into more of them. Millions. Tens of millions. We could get finer control over robot arms. You could catch a ball, write with a pen, do stuff you can't do with current systems.
Go on.
Well, we knew we could get data in too. Nexus nodes talk to each other by radio.
How do they talk by radio?
I don't know. Fucking nanotubes are little radios all by themselves, man. There's a lot of nanostructures in Nexus.
Okay. Software.
Software, yeah. So, anyway, they talk by radio. They sync up. Every node has some way of saying what part of the brain it's in. Every node listens for broadcasts addressed to its part of the brain, so it knows when to fire. If we could crack that, we could listen in on brain activity, and we could make neurons fire in whatever part of the brain we wanted.
Why would that be relevant to your work?
There's a million reasons, more than that. But for us, it was about feedback. Sending the brain information on what the arm was touching, where it was relative to the body. Without that, an artificial limb is useless.
So again, systems like that exist. Why your work?
Same reason. More neurons. Higher bandwidth. Higher sensitivity. More precision. No surgery. Next question?
Software. How did this lead to software?
Yeah. Well, we dosed up some mice, started recording all the signals.
Where did the Nexus come from?
We bought it from a guy on the street.
Stress sensor indicates deception.
Your pulse just shot up 10 points. You're starting to sweat. And your systolic blood pressure just went up by 5. Try again.
We made it.
How?
We autosynthed it.
How'd you get past the sensor chip?
We got access to an old one. It's out of date. The updates haven't been installed on it for years.
Who's the license holder?
Crawford Lab. They've got a newer, fancier one. Their old one mostly just sits idle. I've got access to their lab. They never knew.
Where'd you get the molecular structures?
We got the chemistry from Recipes for a Revolution. I smuggled a hard copy back from India.
And the source material?
All over. It's mostly innocuous. The only problem is there are so many different molecules in Nexus. 63 different molecular parts. The autosynth only had one chem reactor. We had to do 63 runs. Then hand mix in the right proportions.
Okay. Back to the software.
Yeah, fine. So we recorded the signals. It was a bitch. Way too much going on. We did more and more mice studies, tapered down the doses as low as we could go. We started injecting straight into the brain to get the lowest possible doses, simplify the traffic between the mice, simplify the analysis for us.
How long did it take you?
Most of a year. We would do the dosing before we left the lab each day, then record activity overnight. The results made no sense. The signal traffic was chaos. Huge volumes of chaos. There was nothing that looked like the position of the nodes.
And then?
And then we hit pay dirt, man. Cade figured it out. The nodes don't know where they are in the brain. They know where they are relative to other nodes in the same brain. How much position data they send depends on how many nodes there are around them. And it's not even really position data. They figure out what functional region they're in, send that in their signals. It's fucking amazing. Anyway, once Cade figured that out, the data miners cracked the encoding. We could listen to brain activity and trigger new activity anywhere we wanted.
And this led to software, how?
It was the damnedest thing, man. Once we understood the encoding, we could tell there was room for a lot more data in those signals. There were unused bits. So we just started fucking around with it one day, on a lark.
And?
And it would do shit. It would store the data we sent it. If that node sent out a signal again, we'd get the data back. If we sent specific modifier signals, we could tell two nodes to talk to each other, to add their values together, or subtract them. We could do logical operations. It still blows my mind, man.
You'll share these codes with us. All of this data.
Like I have any fucking choice.
So you could make Nexus nodes perform logical operations and math operations. Go on.
Well, that was a huge step. We had an instruction set. We could move data around, we could do conditionals, we could do most of the things a simple chip can do. We had the visual cortex for our display, the auditory cortex for our speakers, the motor cortex for our input. On top of that, we could write any damn software we wanted.
So that's what you did? You wrote the Nexus operating system on top of the instruction set that you discovered in Nexus nodes.
That would have been way too hard. We wanted to do neuroscience, not operating system development, so we ported something instead.
Which was?
ModOS. It's free. The source code is all available. It's built to be portable, modular. Built to run on any kind of hardware down to the simplest possible instruction set. So we took that. We built a simple compiler to turn ModOS into a set of instructions that would run on a set of Nexus nodes.
So, the Nexus OS is really ModOS, running on Nexus nodes as its hardware.
Yeah, you got it.
And on top of that, you've built more software.
Yeah. Well, we've ported other software. Anything that can run on ModOS, we can compile to run on the version that runs on top of Nexus. And we've built software. We had to build the code to send the video output to the visual cortex, stuff like that. And we wrote brand new neuroscience software. We built programs that make it easy to interact with parts of the brain, interfaces. Like an interface to take body shapes, like for a VR app, and tells the motor cortex to put the body in that position, that sort of thing.
This is how you paralyzed Agent Chavez.
Yeah. Dumb shit move, huh?
Discussion of Nexus OS continues for another 17 minutes.
Next topic. You and your co-conspirators give off extraordinarily strong Nexus signals, and they're not dropping. The drug isn't wearing off. How's that possible?
The limit of how much Nexus you can have in your brain is mental. Your neurons fire and the Nexus nodes are trying to coax them to fire. If they're not getting coherence, some of them break apart and get flushed out. Over time, your brain adapts to having a Nexus network. Your Nexus coherence increases. Your maximum possible levels of Nexus go up.
But why isn't the level dropping? It's been more than 8 hours. Most of it should be out of your system.
We call Nexus a drug, but it's not. It's a nanomachine. It doesn't flush out because some enzyme has broken it down. Nexus nodes decompose to their parts because some internal logic has told them to. And if you give them the right signal, They just don't break down at all.
Interview continues for another 18 minutes. 8. Back doors. Cade came out of his tech interview stressed and shaking. It had been an exhausting 2 hours. They drilled deep into what he and Rangan had built. They'd spotted every evasion. They'd known every time he lied or tried to hold something back. Well, he would show them. He signed the papers they gave him. An ERD lawyer watched him, then countersigned the documents. The deal was real now. He would serve as their spy, and in exchange, no one would go to jail. He and Rangan and Ilya would stay in science for just so long as Cade's mission lasted. It was only then that they told him that Watts had gotten away. Good for Watts, he thought. A guard led him to the roof, to the VTOL plane waiting on the helipad. Its wings rotated, its engines turned to the sky for vertical takeoff. The engines were whining already. They ushered him up the stairs, and inside he found Rangan and Ilya, and the agent who would come with them to retrieve the Nexus code from San Francisco.
"Buckle up!"
the agent, who introduced himself as Myers, said over the sound of the engines.
"There's a head in the back! Don't expect any beverage service!"
Cade strapped himself in. Outside the cabin, the engines began to hum, and then to roar. All three of them remained silent as the plane rose slowly into the air, affording them a view of the city. Cade's window faced north, he thought. Where the wing did not obscure it, he could see a river, the Potomac, and across that the Washington Monument and the Capitol. Then the engine swiveled gradually forward, and the plane picked up horizontal speed as well as altitude, and the city receded into the distance. Cade looked over at Ilya. She was withdrawn into herself. She felt tense, wound up. He couldn't see Rangan with the seat back between them, but he could feel his friend's frustration and self-doubt. He wanted to talk to them, but he didn't want to do so in any way Myers could hear. He went inside, found what he was looking for, Mod OS's built-in chat app. He typed the words out on the mental keyboard in his mind, and the text-based chat program sent them to Rangan and Ilya.
"Cade, don't react. We need to talk."
He felt their surprise. They'd forgotten about this app. A moment later, he saw Ilya's response. "Ilya."
"Yeah, definitely."
"Rangan."
"Plus one."
"Cade."
"Put on a movie or something. Put your headphones on. Rangan, you first."
It was a relief to be talking again. He could sense the mood lighten a tiny bit for all of them. Rangan did something in front of him. A minute or so later, Ilya dialed up a nature documentary on her seat-back TV screen.
"Cade."
"Watts got away."
"Ilya." "They told me the same."
"They offered me a deal. Give them Nexus and do a job for them and no one goes to jail."
"You took it?"
"Yes."
"I can't believe you're giving them Nexus 5.
"It was that or life in jail."
"And jail for everyone else at the party."
"Do you have any idea what they'll do with Nexus? What the CIA will do?"
He could feel her anger.
"I know. But they were going to get it anyway. From the drives at the lab, or the backups at my place, or Rangan's."
"He's right. Once they knew it existed, it was too late." "You're going to have an awful lot of blood on your hands then."
"Probably. But there's one thing we can do."
"What?"
"We can make sure we have a back door into their version."
"They already know about the back door."
"A new one. One they can't find."
"How?"
"Remember that article we read last term? The Thompson hack?"
He felt Rangan get it instantly.
"Have the compiler inject it. It'd be in the binary, but gone from the source."
"And have the Mod OS compiler inject into the Nexus compiler."
"Yeah, yeah. Do we have time? How long is this flight going to take?"
5 hours. I'm not following this hack."
Cade explained. The Nexus OS existed in two forms. It existed as human-readable source code that Cade and Rangan or any programmer could read, understand, and modify. And it existed in a binary form that Nexus nodes could understand.
sequences of raw ones and zeros that were almost impossible to work with directly as a human. Between the source code and the binary instructions was the compiler, the program that converted human-readable source code into Nexus-readable binary code. Cade and Rangan would use the compiler to insert their backdoors. Every time the compiler ran, it would search the Nexus OS source code for their new backdoors. If the backdoors weren't there, the compiler would add them before creating the binary version. The only evidence of the backdoors would be in the binary version that was nearly incomprehensible to humans. Finally, they would run the same hack on the compiler itself. The compiler's source code would contain no hint of the logic to insert the backdoors. That would exist only in the compiler's binaries. Anytime their workstation version of ModOS recompiled the compiler, it would insert all the logic of the hack. Rangan felt thoughtful to Cade. Anxious still, he was thinking about the costs of being caught. He came to a decision.
Okay, what the fuck? Let's do this thing.
Rangan and Cade pulled up their development environments and linked them. Ilya linked to their environments and watched over their virtual shoulders. They thought through the plan, divided the tasks up as they turned it from a vague idea into a concrete list of things to do. Plan complete, they set to work. It went quickly at first. The backdoors they cloned from their existing overrides, changing only the passwords. The code in the compiler was conceptually simple, but as they coded, they hit bugs, each one a frustration. They checked the clock constantly. Minutes went by as they worked. An hour. A compiler crash frustrated them for 20 minutes. The fix was trivial once they understood it. A second hour had passed. One of the back doors was leaking memory. How could that be? They'd copied the code from the back door they already had. They figured it out. This fix took longer. A third hour passed. At hour 4, the back doors were working, and the Nexus compiler was adding them. Rangan forced the /obfuscate flag on, instructing the compiler to scatter the new code far and wide as seemingly disconnected, innocuous instructions in the binary, making reverse engineering what they'd done even more difficult. Next, they needed to change the workstation compiler to add the backdoor code to the Nexus compiler. Rangan got on that. Cade turned his attention to the second phase. He wanted to be able to use the back door without the person running Nexus OS knowing. He needed support for hidden processes. ModOS had that in some form. It was simple in theory, but there were so many tendrils. He took large chunks of ModOS code they'd never used and brought them back into Nexus OS. The back doors would connect them to a hidden superuser account. That would do most of what he wanted. Logging would be off for that account. Yes. How to hide the memory usage. Shit. His ears were popping. They were landing. He looked out the window. Fuck! They were at SFO, the airport closest to UCSF. How long from SFO to lab? 20 minutes? 25? Shit! Rangan was done. Cade still had to finish up. Could he hide the memory usage? He didn't see how. He'd have to leave it in. Were there other telltales someone could find? Think. Log files. Had he gotten them all? Network traces? No easy way to hide those. He'd have to leave them in. He glanced outside the window again. The ground was coming up. He cursed under his breath, then caught himself. Fuck. Stay quiet. Stay cool. Okay. He compiled the rev of Nexus OS he had. He had time for only the most basic tests. Compiling, done. He put it in the stress simulator. Did it crash? Not right away. Did it leak memory? Not obviously. Could he still use the back doors? Yes. Could he hide a process from himself? Checking. Looked like it. Would it hold up to real digging? He had no idea. The wheels hit the ground mid-test. Fuck. Still working. Cover for me. On it. Cade went back to work. He could do this. He could finish in time. The pressure in the cabin changed. The door was opening.
Heads up. Focus on the real world for just a minute here.
Meyer stood up.
Okay, everyone out and into the car.
Cade looked out the window. There was a black SUV alongside them, a big guy in a black suit next to it. Fuck. He stood up. The code beckoned. He remembered a flag he needed to change. Shit, what file was that in? Myers walked towards him, locking eyes with him. Cade held his breath. Did he know? The ERD agent stopped.
Come on, let's move.
Myers gestured towards the aisle and the door behind Cade. Cade blinked. Move. Yes, off the plane. He turned wordlessly, stepped into the aisle, went down the stairs behind Rangan. He could feel Myers right behind him. He could imagine Myers' meaty hand coming down on his shoulder. Imagine the ERD agent croaking out,
"You've been trying to fuck with us, haven't you?"
He nearly tripped. Myers caught him by the arm from behind.
"Watch your step,"
he said.
Fuck! Where was his head at? Breathe! Steady!
He made it to the third row of seats in the SUV. Myers closed the door on the three of them and got into the shotgun seat.
Okay, we got you covered.
Ilya started talking.
My car was at Simony Field. Is there going to be a way for me to get it?
Officer Lewis here can take you there after this is over.
I need a ride, too, Rangan said. And I think my key was in a bag inside the hangar. Will that still be there?
And on and on. Cade focused on his work.
Fuck. The new Nexus OS in the stress simulator had crashed after 7 minutes. Shit, shit, shit. Look at the stack trace. What had caused the crash? All he'd done was reactivate standard mod OS code.
Oh, fuck. He'd coded a crude hack to stop all logging. Something must depend on the log files. Sure enough, it was a crash in accessing a log file. Okay, what to do? He created empty log files by hand, let the simulator run again. Another crash. Okay, not empty log files. Log files with a bogus entry in them. He made the mistake of looking out the window. They were on the Bayshore Freeway, right along the water, headed north into South San Francisco, maybe halfway there. Focus, Cade, focus. He copied a random line out of each of the parallel log files in his own Nexus. Copied them to the right places, stepped the simulator forward. Shit! It was still past the point where it had crashed. He rewound it, added the log files again, put in the bogus entries, ran the stress simulator forward. A second passed. 3 seconds. 10 seconds. It hadn't crashed. He was holding his breath, he realized. He let it out. Rangan and Ilya were talking louder and louder. Had he been making noise? He glanced out the window again. The bay was gone. Was that Potrero Hill out the window? Fuck, they were close! He let the stress simulator keep running. He needed to copy the new code into the hidden injector in the compiler. Okay, good there. To test it, run a compile using the injector. See if the file sizes were the same. Compiling, compiling. Fuck, he hated waiting. The freeway curved. That was Soma outside. Shit, they were almost to the exit. The compile finished. Identical. Thank God for small miracles. Cade tossed the code over to Rangan to insert one level further upstream into the compiler's compiler. Rangan got on it. Ilya kept talking. They exited onto Dubose Avenue, then turned onto Market Street. They were in downtown San Francisco now, maybe 2 miles from the lab. What did Cade need to do now? Oh yeah, the source management. He had to fake it out. He got to work convincing the source management system that these changes had always been there. The driver turned on to 17th to cut west toward UCSF. Okay, fake change logs, fake histories, fake file change dates. The car turned and turned again. Rangan's work was done. Cade integrated it. They were on Parnassus Avenue, a few blocks from the lab now, flashing lights ahead. The SUV took a strange turn, came around to the lab's back entrance.
I'll boot the machine and stall him while you copy the new files over. Cool?
Cade nodded.
Shit, stop that, he told himself. What have I missed?
We're here, Myers said. The fire alarm's been set off in the building. We have 20 minutes.
He hopped out and opened their door. They were at the service entrance.
I need to double check this. Keep covering.
Ilya chatted away about lab equipment and fire safety and fire department response times. Rangan took Cade's arm, walked him to the door. There was something he'd forgotten. What was it? There! The separate source tree for Mod OS. The changes to the Mod OS compiler needed to be in there. He had to fix up the file names, the histories, the dates. The light changed. They were in an elevator. Rangan was steering him. Was sweat beading on his brow? Was Myers looking at him? The other officer, Lewis, was he looking at Cade too? He made the simplest change possible. He slapped the new Mod OS binary down in the source tree as the most recent archive version and backdated it by 3 months. The elevator opened. Cade was definitely sweating now. He had to copy these new files onto the server as soon as Rangan got it up, fast enough to fool the agent. Then he had to backdate the file change dates on the server. He needed to maximize bandwidth, get the copy to happen as fast as he could. He went through the apps running in his skull, killed everything that might interfere. Cade killed the development environment, killed the simulator and the stress test, killed as much of his own logging as he could, turned off the body interfaces that Don Juan and Peter North had used. Would that be enough? He heard a beep and snapped his attention back to the outside world. Myers swiped a passkey at the door to their lab, and it opened. Fucking feds.
"Where's the machine?"
"It's over in the corner there," Rangan said. "I'll just boot it up and we can copy all the data for you."
"No need for that," Myers replied. "We'll just take the whole system."
Cade felt his eyes bug out. "Fuck!" Rangan stayed cool.
"You want everything, right?"
Myers narrowed his eyes at Rangan. Cade held his breath.
"Everything,"
Myers said.
"I need to power it up then," Rangan said. "We'll have to download the latest experiment results from the lab server and spool some data down from Simonyi Field."
Myers scowled. "Fuck," Cade thought. "We're busted." Ilya spoke up, strain evident in her voice, playing her part to a T.
"Jesus, Rangan, don't be so fucking helpful."
"Damn it, Ilya,"
Rangan snapped back.
"I'm doing it to keep our friends out of jail."
"Shut up, both of you,"
Myers said.
"We have 17 minutes left. Shankari, let's get this done."
"Yeah."
Rangan led them to the powered-down workstation. He touched a control, and it came to life. Cade stood right next to it, picked up a pen from the desk, did his best not to fidget. Cade searched for the server inside his head as the boot sequence scrolled across the screen.
"Come on, come on, come on."
The Nexus data transfer card they'd used the circuit printer to make was in place. It was flashing green. He refreshed the list of available devices in his head.
Why wasn't it showing up? Where was it? Where was it?
The login message appeared on the screen. "Welcome to Mod OS. Enter credentials." There, Sanchez Lab 018 came online in his head. He navigated its folder tree.
There. Copy.
Rangan flubbed his first password attempt. He shook his head. He flubbed it again. Swore softly.
"Sorry, just a little nervous here."
10% complete. Myers put one burly hand on Rangan's shoulder.
"Take your time," he said, "and no tricks. Think about what you're doing here."
Cade remote logged into the machine, jumped to super user status, got ready to tweak the file date and timestamps after the copy was complete. 25% complete. Rangan nodded. He typed his password again, and he was in.
"Okay, checking the lab experiments directory."
Rangan browsed folders. Cade knew damn well that directory was up to date. 40% complete.
"Yeah, it's out of date,"
Rangan lied. He entered commands to recopy the data.
"That should do it."
Myers' face was a mask.
14 minutes left, and we still need those Nexus files from your fridge."
50% complete. Rangan nodded.
"Okay, pulling down the data from last night."
He opened up a window, poked a tiny hole in the firewall to connect to Simonyi Field, started pulling down log files. 60% complete.
"This shouldn't take more than a minute or two,"
he explained. It took 108 seconds. 80% complete.
"And copying over the documentation," Rangan said.
Myers frowned, looked like he was about to say something. Ilya cut in, stalling.
God, can you make it any fucking easier for them?
Jesus, Ilya, Rangan said. We've been over this already.
That's enough, both of you, Myers said. Power this down, Shankari, now!
The copy was 91% complete. Fuck, fuck, fuck. It would be obvious that they'd been trying to change something. Rangan started to object. Myers held up his hand.
Hold on,
Myers said. He brought one finger to his right ear, plugged it, looked away from them, apparently listening to someone speaking to him. Cade held his breath. 96% complete. 98% complete. He let his breath out. The pen was rattling nervously against the desk. Myers scowled at him in annoyance, took a half step back. 100% complete. Cade jumped in his terminal window to change the time and date stamps on the files. One set done, second set done. Myers pulled his hand away from his ear, looked over at them.
Shut it down, I said. Now!
There was a third set to do. Rangan gulped, nodded, and issued the shutdown command. Windows started.